Trans Resistor Radio.
You are listening to Trans Resistor Radio. I'm your host, Aaron Franz. My website is ageoftransitions.com. Please go to ageoftransitions.com to subscribe to this podcast. Have an RSS feed. You can subscribe through iTunes. You can also download every episode directly from ageoftransitions.com. I hope you will. Save the episodes, share them with others, write a review on iTunes. All of these things go to help me out. And if you really want to help me out, I have written a book called Revolve: Man's Scientific Rise to Godhood. It's about transhumanism, singularity, and even gets into some interesting topics such as alchemy, occult and esoteric matters. And I link those to the transhumanist high-tech idea there. So that might be something you want to check out. I have the first chapter available for free on ageoftransitions.com, so give it a read. You know, check out the free PDF I have, and if you like it, maybe buy the paperback or buy the ebook. I have both available. Other sponsors for the show include Amazon.com. I have banners on my website, ageoftransitions.com. Just go down to the bottom of the homepage, click the Amazon banner, and then if you buy something, I'll get a small percentage of the sale, so you'll be helping me out. So if you happen to buy things on Amazon, check out the banners on ageoftransitions.com. Go through them first. And I also am sponsored by proxbn.com, which is a virtual private network service provider. So go to the links page on ageoftransitions.com to check out the proxbn link. Find out more about it. It might be something you're into if you're concerned about privacy and internet security, things like that. I have a 20% coupon code for their premium service if you're interested in that. Today on Trans Resistor Radio, I'm kicking off the first interview in my series that I'm doing on alternative media. This is going to be a large set of interviews I'm doing. I'm going to interview a lot of people who produce alternative media. So a lot of podcasters, video producers, authors. I mainly want to talk to podcasters, really. And so people doing podcasts and who have their own websites. And I'll get a couple other people too. So this is going to be a really good interview series. I'm very excited already. I just want to get to the bottom of just questions that I have about this. More than that, I just kind of want to feel out this whole alternative media subject and see what others think about it. I think that we're going to get a lot of insights from all of the good people that I talk to. Today on Trans Resistor Radio, I welcome James Corbett of The Corbett Report. Welcome back, James.
It's been a long time since we last talked, but it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for having me on, Aaron.
It has been too long. I'm very excited to talk to you once again. And the series of podcasts that I'm doing here on Trans Resistor Radio are about alternative media, or independent media, if you will. And you're really the perfect person to talk to about this subject. You're a prominent person in the field. You're somebody who puts out a massive amount of material. It's amazing. It's inspiring. And so I'm really excited to get your take on alt media. And I guess to begin with, let's just do a background on you. Like, what inspired you to go into alternative media, to start making your own?
Well, I guess there's a short answer and a long answer to this. So we'll start with the short answer, and you can drill down to the long answer if you're interested. But I guess the short answer is that I was basically just overwhelmed by the discrepancy that I was encountering between the type of information that I was able to find online and the information that I was seeing in the media. And this was on a couple of bedrock issues. Basically, 9/11 truth was one of the bedrock issues for me. And then also the banking system and the money creation process was something that I had never learned about in all my years of schooling, never seen discussed on any of the financial talking head shows or anything like that. And so I'm starting to encounter this information online, and it just strikes me just how incredibly different the world is from what I'd been basically taught or shown my entire life. And that kind of overwhelmed me when it hit me. And I went through the process that I'm sure a lot of your listeners and I'm sure a lot of my listeners have gone through, which is the going down the rabbit hole experience of suddenly not knowing, well, if I've been lied to about these fundamental issues my entire life, well, what else have I been lied to about? And kind of looking for whatever bedrock you can find to start building a base upon. So I went through that process, and that took me a period of months as I started exploring and trying to find information and trying to find my footing and trying to find who can I listen to in the alternative media that I can trust, and what should I be thinking about, and all of that, all of those issues that strike one when you first start going down that rabbit hole. And eventually, basically, I think it was a combination of the information that I was receiving, and then also there was the message that I was hearing from another very prominent alt media figure who I'm sure is very familiar to many people, Alex Jones. And say what you will about him, and even if he is a reptilian Zionist Vatican CIA assassin, he is a very poor one, because it was actually his message saying, you guys can do this, you can spread the word, you got to get out there and get this message out to others. And one day I was listening to that message, and I thought, you know what, absolutely, he's right. And so I thought, that's it, I'm going to start a website. And it was really that simple. It just, I decided on it, and within a couple of weeks, I'd already had kind of the idea for the website, the podcast, what I wanted to do with it, the fact that I was very insistent from the very beginning there was going to be documentation of everything. That was a fundamental part of what I wanted to do, and that was woven into the fabric. I had the idea for the design that I wanted for the website, and I went to my friend here in Japan, and who's a programmer on the side, and I said, well, can you design a website for me? And so I paid him a little bit of money, and he designed the website. And then I had it up and had the podcast going by June 2007. So this whole process took 3 or 4 months tops from the genesis of the idea to actually doing it, which was, it was a whirlwind for me, and one of the most sort of spontaneous decisions I've ever made, and perhaps in the end, one of the best. But that's how it goes. I mean, you just never know where this process is going to stop, and that's where it stopped for me, or that's where it began for me, really.
Yeah.
As I kind of found that I was a part of this conversation rather than just someone listening on the sideline. And it's just once I made that decision, that mental switch, it was all downhill from there.
Yeah, that's great. It is really about the decision to become active and just another person who's part of a discussion, as you're saying, and be just throwing yourself in there. It's not hard to do. And another point that you made there that really something that I noticed was in the waking up process in the beginning for most people, you find that there's lots of omissions from official histories, official narratives on things such as banking. You come to find that those omissions are actually, understanding them is quite simple. It's kind of like a very simple underlying structure to, let's say, finance that we just don't know about. So this isn't anything complicated, is it?
Absolutely not. And that's the thing that continues to strike me, as I'm sure, I have no doubt, if you go out on the street today and ask your fellow Americans, well, where does Congress get its funding? How does it get its money? I am convinced at least 9 out of 10 people would have no clue how that happens. And that is one of the most fundamental issues we can possibly think about if we're going to even pretend to live in some sort of representative democracy where the people are engaged in the system and blah, blah, blah. If you don't even know where the money is coming from for the system, then how can you possibly participate in any meaningful way? And again, it is a very simple process, but one that has been completely neglected from our education. And I would venture to say that's on purpose.
Yeah, it's amazing how basic this stuff is. It always boggles my mind. Now, the Corbett Report is labeled as open source intelligence news. I know if you've talked about this many times, but give listeners here just a definition of what that is and a little explanation.
Right, yes. When I started the website, as I say, back in 2007, when I started doing this research in 2006, one of the things that I came across was this concept of open source intelligence. And I, in the About section of my website, I link to a Washington Times article from 2006, where they're talking about the Open Source Center at CIA headquarters in Langley. And they're talking to the director of the Open Source Center, Douglas Naquin or Naquin, about this concept of open source intelligence. And basically he's saying things like, a lot of blogs now have become very big on the internet, and we're getting a lot of rich information on blogs that are telling us a lot about social perspectives and everything from what the general feeling is to people putting information on there that doesn't exist anywhere else. And so basically the CIA is coming out and saying, well, yeah, we're getting a lot of our information from the internet. I mean, people have this glorified idea of what intelligence work is about, and it's all James Bond and the like. But in reality, I mean, a lot of it is just looking through for information that's already openly available out there. And it really struck me at the time. Well, I mean, the CIA is even operating on this as one of the bases for their intelligence. Then I'm pretty sure it would be good enough for the average person to start doing. And I thought it was a good counter as well to that argument that at least existed quite a bit when I started the website. I think it's starting to die down a little. But that old argument, oh, you saw it on the internet, you know, oh, it can't be reliable if you saw it on the internet. Well, no, even the CIA bases a lot of their information on what they find on the internet. Just because you find it on the internet doesn't mean it's not true. So I thought that was a good way of framing sort of what I was doing, open source intelligence. Well, I'm just looking for information that's widely publicly available. There's nothing secretive about this. I don't have any super top secret sources from inside government or anything telling me what to think or what to say. I'm just doing this myself and just finding stuff online. So that was the idea behind open source intelligence news. And I think I still adhere to that principle. I still think it's extremely important and one that we should be grasping, embracing, as we are here in this age where we still do have relatively free access to this internet. I think it's something that we should at the very least be trying to use as much as possible against the system itself. And that's kind of the basis of what I'm doing.
Sure. Again, I would point out that this is an incredibly basic principle that you're just latching onto. The basic thing being that many good sources of information exist readily available to anybody at all. It's just out there. And you can take that open source and use it for whatever purpose you can creatively come up with, right?
That's exactly right. And of course, they'll try to put various restrictions on that. And of course, one of the biggest that's always existed is intellectual property and all of that nonsense. But it's interesting to watch the way that debate is unfolding now in the internet age and the way that's changing. So of course, news and information and commentary has always been covered by fair use, but fair use is an interesting concept because it is a slippery concept that is...
Yes.
it is purposefully left vague to allow for interpretations of individual situations, which I think is a good principle. I mean, every situation is different and should be evaluated on its own merits. Mm-hmm. But of course, what that ultimately ends up being in this manipulated system is having judges... basically going with whichever side pays them more or, you know, whichever side their bread is buttered on. So it's interesting, for example, there was a very interesting ruling that came down recently about Google Books, which was extremely controversial from the time that it was started back in 2004. The idea of eventually trying to digitize every book in existence is basically their aim.
Yeah.
And this was extremely controversial at the time because authors and publishers banded together and said, well, we didn't give you permission to do this. We haven't approved of this. So, and you're making this searchable online. We want, you know, we need to establish some model where we get a cut of this or whatever. Mm-hmm. So the publishers and the authors banded together and sued Google. And this has been an 8-year, 9-year long legal ordeal so far. And at a certain point, some sort of deal was offered by Google, but that was struck down by the court itself. And then eventually, Google settled with the publishers in an undisclosed agreement outside of court, but the authors were left high and dry. And so they continued forward with the suit. And it was recently just quashed by a judge who said... basically, his ruling was pretty, I think, pretty landmark, because fair use is often determined by things like whether or not someone is making money off of the venture. If you're making money off of it, then you have less of a claim to fair use. It's one of the factors that will go into that decision that the judge will make. In this case, the judge said, yes, even if Google is making money off of this, which they are through their advertising and the like, And people driving people to their website, even if it is making money for Google, it is a valuable enough educational service that it's covered by fair use. And people are using books in a different way than they ever have before. So this is now covered. And so Google Books is now, you know, A-OK. It's been stamped by the courts, seal of approval. What Google did is retroactively perfectly fine. And I think we understand this is because Google, of course, has a lot of pull and influence these days. But at any rate, I mean, it is interesting to watch that debate taking place. And of course, if it was you or I doing anything, you know, anything even approaching something like what Google is doing, I'm sure we would have been sued into oblivion a million times by now. So so it's justice for the rich and something else for the poor. But at any rate, it's interesting to watch the way that this concept of fair use and property rights and intellectual property and the various ways they try to clamp down on people using the open source information. It's interesting to see how that's developing right now in this mix.
Yeah. Oh, boy. You brought up the whole fair use and intellectual property. This, for me, is a subject of endless fascination, of endless mystery, because like you said, everything's open-ended within this realm. And it's also something that I notice in the context of alt and independent media. In my opinion, I don't think independent media producers are familiar enough with intellectual property, with terms like fair use, what that means, what you can legally do. I don't think there's much care given to it. I also think that there's some practices that independent media folks might carry out without thinking about it that I don't know if they'll get in legal trouble, but do you notice this sort of connection between independent media creation and intellectual property?
I think so. I've certainly never really noticed any discussion about this in the alt media or even behind the scenes with any alt media producers that I know about. I've never really discussed this issue. It's never really come up, but this is something that I've thought about since the very beginning, obviously. Mm-hmm. I disagree with the concept of intellectual property itself, but obviously we're living in this system, so it does behoove us to know what the laws are and how they apply. Yeah. And that so that's something I've always thought about with regards to my work and fair use, the use of different copyrighted works that I use in my work for news and commentary purposes. So I am familiar with these laws, but it's always struck me as one of the interesting parts of this is, well, if someone were to say, well, you can't use my copyrighted work in your podcast or whatever, in what jurisdiction would that end up? I mean, yeah. I might be using a source that from, I don't know, Greek television or something that's being rebroadcast in America, and I'm picking it up from there and publishing it on my website, which is, well, I'm in Japan, but the server is in Europe. So, I mean, I don't even know how that morass would ever be sorted out. So, I mean, it is a bizarre kind of thing that's happening right now, and it is a very fluid process that's in the state of flux. But I think you're right. There isn't, I haven't seen at any rate, a lot of conscious thought about these issues in the alternative media, at least not in the people that I've been talking to.
I think there deserves to be more personally. I know that it gets to be a contentious subject too. The point that you made about Google, man, I could talk about Google all day, and Google is such a huge, important thing to understand. But in the context you raised it there, the what it shows us is that these huge institutions get their way. And again, us being independent media producers, we can't get away with the same things. Any thought on what we can do and maybe some advantages we have over the larger institutions such as that they don't have?
Oh, that's an interesting concept. Well, actually, I've got an edition of my subscriber newsletter in the can, or at least in development for on this very topic and talking about this very case. So I'm thinking about this issue right now and the different ways. But it hasn't really occurred to me the advantages that the alt media has in this case, or the smaller independent types have. But I guess there probably are advantages to being small enough, I guess, to fly under the radar in this regard. Yeah. I mean, because a Google obviously cannot act in any way that will not set precedents. I mean, it is a precedent-setting type organization because it is so large and has so much traffic and so many people look to it, that whatever it does is going to be kind of blazing a trail one way or another, legally, if nothing else. So I think, yeah, I mean, a lot of people who just start a little podcast that might have a few dozen listeners at first, I mean, obviously is probably not going to generate enough attention to even generate any thoughts towards intellectual property or that type of thing. So I suppose there is that kind of, you know, I mean, there's a sort of stealth aspect to being small enough to not be cared about, let alone recognized in that regard. But of course, it means that if and when whatever, you know, large organization wants to come along and challenge someone like that in the courts, I mean, a small podcaster probably isn't going to have the resources to really mm-hmm. fight that legal battle. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it means that when and if they want to squash something, it probably wouldn't be that hard. Because, again, as we say, the laws are vague enough and there's enough room for interpretation that the highest bidder is going to get the justice in that case. Justice in quotation marks, of course.
Yeah, and on this point, I just add back to the intellectual property. That's why I would say it'd be best practice for us as independent media producers just to, you know, be careful, you know, and just follow best practices. And at the same time, you know, push the boundaries too with what we're able to do, because we're able to push the boundaries, but, you know, do it in a smart way.
Yes, I agree completely. Well, that's exactly been part of my thought on this as well, is that podcasting and things like this is really a new medium, and we really are precedent setters. We are the people who are determining what this medium looks like, how it functions, and what is the standard and acceptable practices, and what is to be expected in this medium. We are the ones who are actually doing this right now, who are setting this precedent. Mm-hmm. So that is something that I've thought about as well, And I think we are the ones that are doing this. So I think there is a bit of responsibility on us to do it reasonably and to do it well, but also, as you say, to push the boundaries and to show people that, yes, absolutely, podcasters can use these quote-unquote copyrighted materials of news broadcasts or whatever in their work because they are contributing to it. They're making commentary. They're doing reporting of their own. And once we establish that precedent, and it's been there for years and or decades, I mean, it becomes kind of a harder thing for them to unentrench, as it were, through the legal system.
Yeah, it's exciting to be a part of something like this because you or I, James, we are just individual people just making some material and putting it out there, but we're part of something too. So this is a real movement or phenomenon or genre or whatever you want to label it. It's something that maybe even in history books, you know, it will be labeled as a genre, the independent news media genre. And this is what happened in it. And we're living it out now. So there's a real sense of excitement for me personally to, like, kind of have this sense of living history in the present.
I hear you. And I agree with it. And I think that's the mindset that we all need to be in one way or another, whether we're podcasters or not. I think it's more useful for us to understand our current day through the perspective of future history textbooks. And maybe that's a bad way to look at it in the long run, but I mean, just to keep that perspective in mind, that the things that we read about and learn about and study about the figures of the past, they were real humans as well, individuals acting in various ways, and they are the ones who set the course or the narrative of what became our world today. And we are the ones who are acting today, and we will set the course for the future. And when we start to really, I think, understand that and internalize that, I think we can more effectively utilize our existence here on Earth for productive ends, rather than, again, simply being passive kind of receptacles for information. We can actually be people who are spreading awareness and changing the conversation and changing the course of history. And I don't want to self-aggrandize here. I don't think this is something like, oh, I'm so wonderful, I'm setting history. I think we all are. And if we go into it with that conscious understanding of what we're doing, I think it's much more the revolutionary potential in the real sense of revolutionary, I think, is there.
Yeah, and this is a group thing. Again, this is a large movement, genre, whatever, and that's really what's important, and it's important to remember that too. And again, I know that your thoughts have been in this realm as of late, and that's why I'm so excited to have you on talking today. You have a series that you do at Corbett Report entitled Solutions, and it's just various solutions. And one that you did recently was Solutions Make Your Own Media, and you did this with Brock West. What was your purpose, perhaps, in producing that, or what was your experience of producing it, too?
Yeah, well, there's a funny count on that part. But in terms of why I kind of put that together, it's a question that I get constantly through my contact form from various people. Is just everyone has a question like, oh, how do you do this? Or what software do you use for that? What camera do you use? I get those kinds of questions on if not a daily basis, at least regularly enough that I realize that a lot of people out there are thinking about this. And since a fundamental part of my message has always been and will always continue to be, you guys out there can do this as well, and I'm not doing anything particularly special, and I always encourage people, if they feel they're able to or called to do podcasting or whatever it may be, I always encourage people to do it. Well, I might as well kind of put my media where my mouth is and show people what I do and kind of reveal, you know, the big secrets. It's not a big secret. There's no big curtain. It's a pretty simple process. And if people saw, you know, the six tatami, I don't know what that is in square meters, but the very small bedroom from which I'm doing my podcasting. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous in a certain way, but it's the power of the independent media. So basically, my idea was just to kind of help people, to show people the software that I'm using, some of the hardware, and talk about some of the issues in making media. And the big irony of that was that one of the things that I was testing that day when we were actually recording that with when Brock was here in Japan visiting, I had a brand new camera, a Canon 70D, which is just a beautiful camera. It takes wonderful video, and I was so excited about it. Oh wow, look at this! I want to. It's like a new toy, you know. Oh, yeah. I want to play with it.
Sure.
So we got it all set up, and we had three cameras going at one point. I had my iSlave device as well, just doing a little bit of recording as well. So I had three cameras set up and had audio being recorded separately, and all of this. I mean, it almost looked semi-professional, the setup that I was using, and I was so happy about this. And wow, I'm going to put this together. And so I go to put it together, and I have a huge problem. I cannot render the video file, and I'm pulling whatever hair I don't have out of my head. And what's going on? And so I, literally for 2 or 3 days, I was trying to figure out what was happening and why this video wasn't working and blah blah blah. And then I realized there was because of the format that the Canon camera records in, I have to do an extra step of kind of processing that video recording before I put it into my Final Cut editing program, and all this kind of hassle. But I eventually figured it out and got it through and got it up. But it was just so ironic because I'm talking about the process of making media and how I'm not a professional. I'm just kind of teaching myself how to do it. And in the process of making that podcast, I had to learn a new step in the whole workflow. So it was a great learning process for myself as well. And I guess a teachable moment for people out there that, you know, I mean, I'm still learning and I'm still kind of winging it. And I'm sure there are people out there who know much more about cameras and all of this than I do. But it's just a question of, again, going out there and trying it and pulling your hair out and eventually getting it. And nothing feels better than when you have a technical problem like that and you overcome it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they are just technical issues too. Technical issues can be this obstruction to getting things done, for myself included. I know it has been in my life. I can think back at times when it has been. But also an example from my life would be when I just choose to say, hey, you know what? This technical issue isn't beyond me. It's just a simple, mechanical thing I have to figure out, which is not beyond me. I can do it. And then once I do, I'll just, you know, get the thing done. And that's the real object, is the actual doing. It's not the technical side really at all.
Yeah, I mean, often with a lot of my technical problems, I don't think I come up with the real answer, quote unquote. I think I come up with workarounds that, well, it works.
Exactly.
And that's, at the end of the day, that's all that matters. I mean, I don't particularly care if I'm doing it the quote unquote right way, as long as it works in the end.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even if you learn from professional media producers, professionals, they'll say there's a million ways to do one thing. So that's, again, encouraging too, is that there's not just a template to do. There's no standard really for anything. You just got to find your own unique way to do it, and it'll be okay.
I wholeheartedly believe that, and I guess I'm living proof of that. So, I mean, because for people out there who don't know, I had zero experience or training in media whatsoever before I started the podcast, so everything was a learning curve for me. And I think you hear that in the very earliest episodes of the podcast, which are almost unlistenable, not only because I myself had not really found my voice at that point, but also because of the technical issues with the podcast. And just I had no idea what I was doing, and it shows. But but again, you know, it's a process of just sticking with it and overcoming it. And hopefully, if the content that you're putting out there is interesting enough, people will stick through those types of issues. And it took me an awfully long time to get to where I am now. And I'm sure I still have a lot of growing and learning and changing to do in the meantime. But I it's an exciting process. It genuinely is. And I might cringe to look back at my early episodes, but I mean, I to look at the kind of big arc of where I've come from and what I'm doing now, and to think and reflect on that, I mean, that is an actual accomplishment that I really am proud of. And that's something that you can't really put a finger on. It's not something you can really understand, I think, from the outside. It's something you have to experience to really understand, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's almost like a rite of passage, you know. It's like, I've chosen to do this thing, I'm doing it. In the beginning, obviously, it's not quite as good as it's going to be later. You know, it's just like living a life. When you're a little child, you're not going to understand things quite so well. But when you come of age, you have a greater context of things. And what you do has more substance because of the wisdom you've gained. And the media we produce has this same effect. And it's just, again, if you stick with something, it's going to get better.
Exactly. And the best compliment I've ever received and continue to receive is when people write comments on my YouTube videos like, oh, he's just an English teacher in Japan. How does he know how to do all this? Implying that I have, you know, some CIA backing to make my media or something, which is, you know, that's a wonderful compliment. People are so astounded that a person can teach themselves how to do this that they actually can't believe it, which is great. You know, I mean, that just goes to show you know, if I can do it, literally anyone out there can do it. So I'm just blown away by how people have gotten into the mindset that this is something that can only be done by professionals with years of training. That's a lie. That's a lie that they love to sell you because it keeps you in the position of being just a passive audience member. But but once you break through that conditioning, it's amazing what can result.
Yeah, passive audience member. I think about this so often because it relates here to creating independent media, but it also relates to consuming media at large. You can be sitting as part of an audience watching a movie, which a movie can be produced for propaganda purposes, and they often are in our world, plenty of evidence for that. So you can be sitting in a movie theater watching a propaganda piece and just be a passive observer. And if you are, the propaganda works, and that's how it works. It's when you become an active participant, or certainly active mind, that you're able to see things for what they are.
Agreed. I mean, I think there really is a difference in the consciousness with which you are, I don't want to say observing, but the consciousness that you take into a work of art or a film or whatever it is going to determine that experience to a large extent. And I think you're exactly right. If people just passively go in like zombies, they are going to be fed a bunch of images and a bunch of information and a bunch of ideas. And if they're not in control of that process, then it is going to control them.
Yeah. And this discussion leads us right into using independent media to analyze mainstream media. And that's exactly what you're doing with your Film, Literature, and the New World Order series on your podcast. And I wanted to talk to you about this. So what was the initial impetus to go in this direction with your podcast?
Well, this is kind of the natural, I think, place for me to be at with my work. I mean, I think this is what I was always probably aiming at or expected to do at any rate, given my background and training. I mean, I was an English lit major in university, and what do you do with an English degree? My old refrain was always frame it, which is about the only thing you can do with it. Actually, I haven't even framed my degree, which goes to show how much I think about that piece of paper. But it was interesting. My other response was people always ask me, "What are you going to do? You know, what job are you going to do?" do. And I always said, I will, well, I don't know, but I'm not going to be a teacher. I'm not going to be a reporter. And I ended up being both. So I guess you really are determined by what you study. But so when I started doing this, I mean, I've always been interested in literature. I've always been interested in studying, you know, works of art and things like that and kind of, you know, analyzing them. I mean, that's what I did for many, many years. So it was always just kind of a natural fit for me to see how that fit in with this new alt media thing that I was doing. And so it's a great way for, it's also a great excuse for me to take a moment out and, you know, read a novel or watch a movie rather than simply focusing on the news all the time, which is what I guess I probably would be doing if I didn't have this excuse to go around it. So it's been a wonderful experience for me in that regard. I get to kind of approach it from a completely different angle. And I think a lot of people really do appreciate that. I've had a lot of feedback on this series and a lot of people are, you know, really seem to appreciate having something a little bit lateral, something that's not just straightforward news. It's a way for people to get kind of their claws into this in a way that's very non-threatening. Obviously, people like to watch movies. They like to read books, perhaps decreasingly so, but still a lot of people out there like to read books. So it is a way for them to approach this information from a completely different perspective and hopefully to bring in other people who wouldn't care to watch a news report but would be interested to hear a discussion about a work of art. So I'm very excited about this. And I the only problem really is that I have had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people writing in to say, well, you should cover this. You should cover this. You should look at this. You should. And I physically can't cover all of these ideas. But it shows there's a great hunger out there from people for more of this type of analysis.
That's another point on why maybe we should be doing this is because there's such a resource to go on. There's an endless amount of material to draw from. So we could do this forever.
Oh, and there's no doubt. Yeah. Yeah. I have 100 books I could think off the top of my head that I'd love to analyze.
Yeah. Yeah. do you, in terms of the suggestions from listeners, Do you follow up on them? Do you find that you do that a lot? You follow up on the suggestions?
To be perfectly honest, no. one thing that I've learned over my 7 years of doing this now is that I get a lot of feedback and tips and ideas from people, and I really do appreciate it when they do take the time to do it. But I have learned over the years to trust my instincts, my natural inclinations. Mm-hmm. If there is an idea or a movie or something that someone suggests that I think sounds interesting, I'll follow it up. And if it doesn't strike me that way, I won't. And I have learned over the years to trust that, because ultimately, at the end of the day, the Corbett Report is the Corbett Report. So it's going to have to be filtered through me and what I find interesting and what I choose to pursue. So I have to trust to a certain extent that I, you know, my instincts on that. And I've found every time I cover something because someone told me to cover it, only because someone told me to cover it, it turns out not being a particularly good report or not an interesting interview or what have you. Yeah. When I do something because it's something that genuinely, spontaneously comes from me, from within me, it's always better. And that's just something that I've learned over the years. So I do appreciate all of the many, many, many suggestions that come in from people for that and for my news coverage, etc. But at the end of the day, it has to be something that's sparked within myself, something that really appeals to something that I want to do.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned this because it brings up so many points. For one thing, it brings up the point how independent media, when it's produced, it lends itself to catering to whoever's the particular tastes and unique strengths of whoever's producing it. And therefore, each media producer is going to be putting out something unique, and it's going to be worthwhile for very specific and dynamic and very human reasons, because each human's a different person. And also, if perhaps somebody who emails you a suggestion and they're not satisfied by you because you never fulfill their suggestion, well, maybe that just means that perhaps that person could make something themselves, and that would be all the
Bingo.
Better.
Yep. That's exactly it. And that would be my message to people out there. I mean, people are motivated enough to email someone, you know, halfway around the world that they've never met to try to get them to cover something that you're interested in. Well, maybe that shows, you know, maybe you can be doing this yourself. There is interest out there in this type of material. And this would probably be the easiest way for people to get involved in this, because it might be intimidating for people to start commenting on news and things like that. That seems like some kind of rarefied specialized skill, but everyone likes talking about movies and books and that type of thing. And it has a built-in audience as well, because everyone loves hearing that kind of discussion. So, or a lot of people do in this day and age anyway. So I think it's a great opportunity for people to start thinking about how they can contribute to this rather than just waiting for someone else to cover what they want to hear.
Yeah. And this also points out that, alt media doesn't have to be news media proper. It can be something akin to doing a movie review. So it can be fun. So it doesn't have to be this sort of just like you're relaying news to people. It can be whatever you want it to be, correct?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And I mean, again, I try to approach this in a lot of different ways. I have the Truth Music series that I've done in the past of trying to highlight different musicians and independent, you know, creators in that regard. And there's so many different ways to approach this. And it has to be, again, it has to come down to what people's individual strengths and abilities are. And obviously the Corbett Report is filtered through my own strengths and abilities and interests. But there's so many opportunities out there for people to take up this in a way that appeals to them. I get emails from people who are interested in poetry, who are trying to use their talents in that regard, and people who are musicians, people who are visual artists. So many people who come at this from a different perspective that it's not always easy for me to cover that on the Corbett Report, but I'm always supportive of people who are out there doing that. And I think, again, we've got to start building this community, because there are so many people out there doing these types of things. And I think it is important for us to, again, start putting ourselves in the position of not being the audience, but being the active participants in this conversation, and starting to form that community, the alternative community that hopefully will completely supplant the Hollywood big publishing house paradigm that has, you know, been that prison around our brains for so long now.
Yeah, the potential is there, and all things independent, whether it be an independent artist or musician or poet, their work could be featured on something like the Corbett Report or what have you. And in so doing, the two separate things, the Corbett Report and the independent poet or whatever, become one sort of thing, and it becomes a movement. I think that's where our opportunity to grow comes from. And again, it's about being creative, and it's a networking sort of thing too. What do you think about networking?
You know, the term actually sounds, I don't like it.
yeah.
Maybe just the term. Because I have the image of plugging into some big network and, you know, becoming another node. Yeah. I'm conflicted about this in a lot of different ways, because, for example, this always brings up the point that a lot of people make, and I wonder if we've been programmed to make this point. It occurs so often, but so many people come and say, well, you know, why don't a bunch of you get together and make one big website where we can get all your work from? And I understand the appeal of that type of idea. Well, why don't you just create that big community and then we can all just access it from there? But I think that, honestly, I think the internet revolution, if it is such, and I know we've talked about that word revolution, so you know we use it in quotation marks,
but the
internet revolution, for whatever it is, I think is an opposite idea. I think it upsets that idea that we've had for so long, that we all need to band together and come together in this one website under this one banner and all, you know, wave the same flag in order for people to find us all in that one spot, and we can all congregate in that one spot. I think what's happening online is the explosion of that idea. Instead of all needing to come under one banner and all come together in the one spot so everyone can use that one spot as the communal access point, no, the internet is designed so that everyone can have their own address, literally and, you know, figuratively. They can have their own banner. They can have their own thing. And we come together and we do things like this where we have conversations and we collaborate and we work together, you know, as need be. But at the end of the day, I'm still James Corbett and I'm still the Corbett Report, and the Corbett Report is still my work. And I don't have to subscribe to any particular banner or collaborate with people that I don't necessarily want to collaborate with, because it's all part of this one big community. So I think we are upsetting that notion of what a community is and what a network is and how we go about networking and all of that type of thing, because there is a different paradigm. That we are in a different paradigm where in the past, obviously, physical space, physical travel, the ability to physically congregate has always been that kind of natural cap on what a community is. We are no longer in that type of world. And for all of the terrible transhuman ramifications of, you know, cyberspace and all of this, it still does have that potential to be a very freeing, very liberating thing where we can come together as individuals with our own spaces and our own, we don't have to give ourselves over to any sort of unifying ideology if we don't want to. We can maintain our independence and yet at the same time still be together and collaborate and that type of thing. So it's a very complicated answer to a very simple question, but I hope it makes some sense, because I really think there's something important in there about the discrepancy I see between the people who are always emailing me saying, well, why aren't you all together in one website? And my idea, no, why do we have to be? This is online. You're one click away from anything you want. So why not all be ourselves and come together as need be?
Exactly. Part of the whole mission here is to, you know, work within a new paradigm and try to somehow free ourselves from the shackles that is even paradigm thinking itself, I guess you could say. With the mainstream media, it was one big source from which everything came, and so that's where our minds are at. And I guess to free ourselves from that, it almost takes active participation in doing that. And so the independent media producers are doing that. I think maybe are the first ones to sort of find an answer to big media and just getting your standardization in general, I guess you'd say. What can everybody else do, I guess, in that sort of same vein? How can they start just thinking along different lines that will be will help to free them, I guess, in a generic sense?
Yeah, well, I think you kind of hit on it there. Again, it's about the active part of that process, because I completely understand what people mean from the perspective of convenience, and let's not put too fine a gloss on it, laziness. I mean, it would be so much easier if you could just type in one address into a search bar and find the one site where all of the good information is, and that's all you ever have to do. That would be, you know, I understand the appeal of that. It would be very, very efficient. We'll put it that way, to put it nicely. But ultimately, that is laziness, and that's part of, again, that passive mindset. We are just the receptacles. We want it as easy as possible for you to just, you know, download your data into our minds, basically, is what that's saying. On the flip side of that is, if this is an active community of active participants, people who see themselves as an active part of this conversation, then part of that is seeking out new sources of information, seeking out that information that lies online, and following the connections. So someone who's listening to my podcasts hears you and, oh, well, what's this all about? And goes to theageoftransitions.com and starts looking through your information. Wow, this is a new source of information. That process of discovery, I think, is part of the fun of this as well. I mean, it is fun to encounter new sources of information, new people. Wow, this is a new voice with a new perspective. I've never heard this before. Yeah. That is a genuinely pleasurable experience for me when I encounter it, and I would hope for other people as well. So I hope that process is part of the actual point of what we're doing, the process of getting people to engage and to discover and to seek out and to keep following these connections and to keep looking and actively, you know, searching this out. Because again, if it was just this one website where everyone goes to and plugs in and just download the data, then what's the process of discovery there? What do you bring to that as an individual? You're just being kind of a data download receptacle in that case, rather than someone who's contributing to it and following, you know, the cookie trail and moving from here to there. So I think that the ultimately it's the process itself that is a part of this that determines the mindset through which we can hopefully understand what it is to be free. I mean, freedom and liberty and things are things that I talk about a lot, but I think we don't even really understand what that means until we start actively engaging with that topic and trying to incorporate it into our life. And again, if all we're after is convenience, if all we're after is kind of that passivity of experience, then I think we're not really utilizing freedom to the fullest and not really understanding what that concept is or why it's valuable. So part of this is not even about the content itself, although obviously I hope the content is important and does change people's minds and understanding. But part of it is just the process of getting engaged and discovering there are voices out there and encountering that and engaging with those voices and becoming part of the conversation. That in and of itself is valuable.
You know, James, something just occurred to me. I want to run this by you and get your thoughts on it. Do you think that perhaps the mainstream media, with their many manufactured personas, such as, you know, your Justin Biebers, your Kardashians, your people who are famous for fame's sake, do you think they're being put out as sort of an example of why the system is enticing and what people maybe try to get viewers to want to aspire to be a Kardashian, like, oh, that's the ultimate, that's what I want to have in my life? And is that being put out as a way to suck people back into the system and maybe dissuade them from becoming empowered and making their own independent thing? Do you think that's a possibility?
There's an element of that for sure. And I think that that appeals to kind of lowest common denominator. I mean, that appeals to kind of the youth who are easily, I think, swayed by that type of mass culture phenomenon and, oh, you know, I want to be Miley Cyrus, I'll start twerking or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I've been thinking about this recently, and I think there is a much more interesting layer to that propaganda, because of course, you know, there's that element to it that they want to put these figures out there as people to be emulated or what have you. But there's a deeper element to this, because what is the overriding sentiment that people see online so often when talking about, for example, the Kardashians or Bieber or people like this? The overriding sentiment that I see online, at any rate, is hate. I mean, yes. People hate these people, and they love to hate these people. So to a certain extent, I think these types of figures are put out there to be those recipients of the hatred, for to give us the feeling that, we're superior, we're above those, you know, those Kardashians and the Biebers. They're silly, they're dumb, we're so awesome, and we can, you know, we can vent our hate out on them. Oh, look at how dumb they are, those stupid plastic figures up on the screen, they're useless. And that gives us a feeling of importance without even having to really do anything. I mean, just by virtue of existing, we feel we're superior to these people. Which, again, I mean, I don't know these people on a personal level. I don't know anything about them, and neither do you, unless you actually know them on a personal level. All we are encountering, really, is the kind of media face of these people, the kind of virtual whatever it is that their character has become, the caricature that has been painted of them. And so why do we feel so superior to this? And why do we spend so much of our time hating on these people, these plastic figures, if they are so unimportant, which they, I think they are. I mean, at least the caricatures are. Why do we spend so much of our time engaging with it? And it's because, I mean, I think this is a layer of propaganda they've figured out. They figured out if they put these objects out there to be ridiculed, then that's still a way of getting people to engage with the system and to feel superior to it, maybe, but still to engage with it. So I think there's a very subtle layer of propaganda going on there. And again, overcoming that means, at the end of the day, not caring, not clicking on that Kardashian headline, not caring about it at the end of the day. And that's something that's a lot harder to do than just hating on it.
You know, it's uncanny, James. I'm going to say this, and people are going to have to take me at my word, but I had the exact same thought about that subject that you just described in detail. That same stuff went through my head a week or a few days ago. It was just recently. And perhaps the way that I framed a question led you to say that. Maybe it was something in my subconscious that sort of like...
I swear I've been thinking about this recently. I have had that exact thought recently.
Yeah. And, you know, the possibility exists that perhaps we had the same thought at the exact same time. This gets a little wacky, but I want to get your take on... What do you think about the realm of ideas and that there's sort of like... it's a real thing and that people kind of tap into it and people have the same thoughts at the same time. And I think, what's your take on all that?
Let me come up with a much more prosaic explanation and see if it is at least something we can take on board. I don't know about you, but I spend a lot of time listening to podcasts and engaged in the alternative media. I assume you do as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the possibility is that we've been listening to similar ideas from similar media and we came to the same conclusion. I don't know what really it was that got me thinking along those lines, but to a certain extent, it was seeing headlines about Miley Cyrus or whatever recently has got me thinking along those lines. And why? What is this phenomenon? So, I mean, it could just be different people approaching the same topic from different perspectives, maybe, and coming to the same conclusions because those conclusions exist objectively and verifiably in the real world.
Yeah.
So maybe nothing so mystical about it. But at the same time, I don't want to dismiss that. I do think there is something interesting to explore in the realm of ideas and how people access them and what it means, because there are different ideas that come up in different places and cultures and contexts that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to. And they're things that I think about from time to time. And maybe they have very prosaic explanations, but maybe not. And one of those things that I've been thinking about recently, in fact, here in Japan, as I've discussed on my podcast before, I used to be an English teacher here in Japan, and I've been doing the website full time for the last couple of years. For the last year or so, though, I've been teaching just on Sundays, just at a private school here. I said I'd help them out on Sundays. So I've been doing that for the past year. And recently I was teaching a lesson, and it was an article about it was a bizarre article about some scientific experiment that I think it's real. I don't know. It's in a textbook, but I think it might have been a real experiment. Something about if you wash your hands after making a decision, you will feel more neutral about that decision. If you don't wash your hands, you will actually try to justify that decision to yourself. It was a bizarre psychological experiment. But I was bringing this conversation up with the student in the context of, well, in the West, we have this concept of hand washing your hands of a decision. And it goes back to the Bible and Pontius Pilate washing his hands of the decision to crucify Jesus. And then you have Lady Macbeth going crazy and washing her hands, you know, in her sleepwalking to get rid of the blood and blah, blah, blah. And that concept, I was saying, is part of kind of Western cultural history. And I was asking if there's anything similar in Japan. And she's saying, well, yeah, I mean, in Japanese dramas, you know, you'll have the murderer, you know, obsessed with washing his hands and blah, blah, blah. And so that brings up the question of what is that idea of hand washing then? Is it something that is part of some sort of collective unconscious that we have? Is it just a basic psychological fact of human existence that we equate hand washing with getting rid of guilt or something like that? I mean, what is that idea and how is it tapped into by different cultures and yet they arrive at similar ideas about it? And things like that are very fascinating to me. I don't have any real set answer to it, but I think it is, you know, it's fascinating to think about.
Yeah, I don't think anybody has any real answers to these sorts of questions. However, that doesn't mean they're questions that we should not pay attention to and come to sort of individual answers ourselves. I think that's so much of what people really should spend a large portion of their lives doing. That's my sort of personal philosophy on it. It has to do with consciousness and the mystery of that. And I, of course, we see alternative and independent media kind of turning its attention to consciousness a lot more. And I think that's only a good thing. And with that, I'd just like to ask you, James, if there's anything else along these lines that you'd just like to mention. And if not, just let listeners know about your website and your work, of course.
I don't think I could ever stop talking about this once I get going. This is a fascinating conversation. So I think we'll have to continue this conversation at some point in the future. But maybe that'll do it for now. I mean, there's so many different ways to explore. I wouldn't even know what to mention. So I'll just say, for people who don't know, I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. And that's the one-stop shop for all of my information, all of it completely available freely for download, literally thousands of hours of media there. So I hope people will sift and explore through there for things that interest them and use that as an entry point into my vast treasure trove of archives, or that's what I like to think of it as. And for my listeners who are listening to this on my website, perhaps you can tell them about yourself.
Yes. Well, I'm Aaron Franz. My website is ageoftransitions.com. And similarly, I just do podcasts, articles, made videos. The website's just a resource for that. So check it out.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I think that's going to have to do it for today. But as I say, this is a fascinating conversation. So I think
it is. And like you're saying, we're gonna have to continue this, and maybe we'll get to the bottom of this consciousness business next time, James.
yeah, I think we'll roll up our sleeves and get it knocked down in an hour.
So I want to thank listeners as always. This is Trans Resistor Radio. I'm Aaron Franz. As always, seeker, seek on. Nothing in life is free. Better start earning. Physically never felt better. My stature for status of cheddar was lower. I'm negative debtor for having it. All those who really mean freedom just took a celebrity in general. Honestly, I got a knack for the heaven and minimal galactic supernova natural. Must have king clapping, suffering, suck at that. It's too long and you will get a bumper and hit up and crush the dreams of being a decadent king. Bear the ring, turn out the max out, cast out, pass out, pass out. Typically I spaz out, then I cast out. Don't black out, memory hole. Tends to be wanking out of control. Stumble on down to the gutter of dungeon. Result of no one in the company. Lunch is a heaven, the fall isn't heaven at all. I'd rather stand broke than do the rich crawl. One day I'll only hope to maintain. When I get old and I'm holding a cane. See me, not trusting the network hacks who cast a spell. Be a deviant back, I have more trust in the tablets. Free peace, taking more faith than a witch. Don't get it over like to do. Blow it, blow your money. Oh no, you go broke worse off than you were before. There's a door in the pasture, pasture with us. Or sword freely, in the servant turf. Once in a while, let life be easy. Other times back from the ground with a diligent, rigorous flash. The third eye squeegee.
Today's episode of Trans Resistor Radio was recorded on the 15th of December, 2013.